Down at the depot, Matt Jensen was unaware that a young boy had seen everything and had tried unsuccessfully to tell the truth about the shooting. From his perspective right now, the future looked pretty bleak.
Oh, train's coming.
Those who were waiting for the train got up and started toward the door.
Don't be getting anxious now, killer. We'll let the decent folks on first. All right, killer, on your feet now. Let's go.
Stepping outside onto the wide wooden boarding platform, Matt saw that the sliding door on the side of the express car was open, and that the express man inside the car was squatting down to talk to the station agent. Both the express man and the station agent glanced over toward Matt and Deputy Hayes, so Matt knew they were talking about him. After a moment, the agent made a waving motion to them.
All right, looks like Randall's worked it out for us. Come on, let's go.
With Hayes' hand on Matt's elbow, the two men walked over to the express car, as it was the first car after the coal tender. The engineer looked at Matt, and Matt met his glance with a steady gaze of his own. The engineer nodded a greeting at him, which, under the circumstances, Matt greatly appreciated.
All right, killer, you get on first.
Not gonna be easy with these chains.
Yeah, well, I'm not about to pick you up and throw you on, so I suggest you get on the best way you can.
Matt put his hands on the edge of the car, then vaulted up easily.
Well, now, I'm real impressed. You done that just real good. You, express man.
The name is Kingsley, Long Kingsley.
All right, Kingsley.
Hayes gave the express man his gun.
Keep him covered till I get up there. He's a killer.
A killer?
Yes, be careful with him.
Nervously holding the gun, Kingsley stepped back away from Matt.
Don't you try nothing now.
Easy, mister. You don't intend to try anything.
With some effort, Hayes managed to climb up into the express car. He reached out for his pistol.
I'll take that back now.
Kingsley handed the pistol back to Hayes, who put it in his holster.
Weren't you gonna keep him covered?
Why, he's in chains. It's for sure he's not going anywhere.
I guess not.
Don't worry, we won't be that much of an inconvenience to you.
I reckon the two of you can ride with me as long as you stay out of my way. I'll be processing mail along the way.
We won't be no bother.
Hayes pointed to the end of the car where there was one chair.
Sit there.
Matt started to sit on the chair.
Not the chair. The chair is mine. You'll be sitting on the floor. So you may as well sit there now and make yourself comfortable.
As instructed, Matt sat down on the floor, leaned his back against the wall, and closed his eyes. He and Hayes no sooner got settled than the engineer opened the throttle. Shortly after the train left the depot, Cummins held a meeting of all his deputies.
All right, boys, it's time to go to work. You fellas know what stores, businesses, and homes you're responsible for. Get started, then bring it all to the saloon.
Marshal, maybe we'd better ease up a bit.
Ease up a bit? What the hell do you mean by that, crack?
Well, I mean, some of the folks, at least the folks I'm dealing with, are beginning to get a little contrary about paying taxes every week.
Oh, they are they?
Yeah.
Well, that's just too goddamn bad.
So what do I tell them when they start complaining like that?
Tell them it's the law. If they want to live in my town, they have to pay the piper. And we're the piper. Are you going to have a problem with that?
No, I ain't going to have a problem with that. I was just commenting, that's all.
If I want any comments, I'll ask for them. What about the rest of you? Any of you have any trouble with this?
None of the deputies responded.
Boys, when you think about it, we got us a real sweet deal here. You might say that we have a license to steal. Ever since the city council voted to put in the law tax, all we have to do is just control a few drunks, make sure no one gets a beat up, and arrest anyone who spits on the sidewalk. Now what do you say we get to work?
At the very moment Cummins was charging his deputies with the task of spreading out to collect the law tax, a secret meeting was being held in the back room of the Bank of Purgatory. Joel Montgomery, the president of the bank, was conducting the meeting, and he poured himself a drink before calling the meeting to order.
Goodman, are you keeping a lookout?
Yes, there's nobody out on the street.
Well, there will be soon. This is the day they spread out to collect their tax. So, if you see anyone coming this way, let me know.
I will.
Men, there's a bottle here. If any of you want a drink before we get started, get it now. Because once we get started, we've got some serious business to discuss.
It ain't going to work.
What isn't going to work, Anion?
Anion Goff owned the leather goods store.
All of us getting together and telling Cummins we ain't going to pay his taxes no more. It ain't going to work.
And why won't it work?
Because a tax is a law that's done been passed by the city council. If we don't pay it, why, they've got the right to put us in jail. What we need to do is get the city council to pass a law changing that.
And how do you propose we do that, Anion?
Josh Taylor ran the feed store.
There's only 7 men on the city council, and 4 of them are Cummins deputies.
I don't know how we're going to get it done. I just know that if one of us refuse to pay the taxes, we're going to wind up one of 2 ways. Either dead or in jail.
Yeah.
Drew Bascom owned the freight line.
Even if we fight back, we could wind up getting hung. You seen what happened to that stranger that rode in here today? Gillis tried to collect the $5 visitor's tax, and the stranger shot him. Now, I say good for the stranger, except and he's on his way to Yuma to get hung.
Yes, I heard about that. Did any of you see it? I mean, how is it that it just happened today, and already the stranger has been tried and convicted? The judge isn't even in town.
Cummins held the trial himself. Within 5 minutes after it happened, Cummins had a jury picked, and he held the trial right there in the Paradise Saloon.
Well, that's not legal, is it? I mean, can Cummins hold a trial without the judge?
Yes, you may remember that Cummins got himself appointed to a judge. His authority might be questionable, but he probably was within his rights to conduct the trial. Now, as to the trial itself, I'm sure there will be all sorts of technical errors that would qualify for an appeal. For example, does anyone know if he had a lawyer?
Bob Dempster was his lawyer.
Oh, Bob Dempster. Good Lord, was Dempster sober?
When is the last time anyone saw Bob Dempster sober?
Damn, the stranger could appeal this case a dozen ways from Sunday.
Maybe so, but he just left on the train to Yuma. Chances are he'll be hung by this time tomorrow night.
Fellas, here comes crack.
Well, what are we gonna do? Are we gonna pay the tax this week or refuse?
We'll pay them. Right now we have no other choice. But I don't intend to go on paying them forever. We're going to put a stop to this. There is no way I'm going to let this go on.
How are we
going
to stop?
I don't know yet. That's what we're going to figure out as soon as we get organized.
At the same time Joel Montgomery and a few other citizens of the town were holding their meeting, Robert Dempster was sitting in a darkened room in the back of his office. A half-full whiskey bottle was on his desk in front of him, and he reached for it. Drew his hand back, reached for it again, and again drew his hand back. His head hurt. His tongue was thick. His body ached in every joint, and he had the shakes. He reached for the bottle again, picked it up, and filled his glass. Though he was shaking so badly that he got nearly as much whiskey on the desk as he did in the glass. Putting the bottle down, he picked up the glass and tried to take a drink, but the shaking continued, and he couldn't get it to his mouth. He put the glass down, leaned over it, took it in his lips, then tried to lift the glass that way, but it fell from his mouth and all the whiskey spilled out. In a fit of anger, Dempster grabbed the bottle and threw it.
No!
He leaned his head back, then pinched the bridge of his nose. Robert Dempster had not always been an alcoholic. In fact, he had once been a productive member of society, a husband, father, and vestryman in his church. As he sat in the dark room, his body rebelling against the denial of alcohol, he began to remember, though they were not memories he wanted to revisit. In fact, he drank precisely so he wouldn't have to remember. But despite his best efforts, those memories, unbidden though they might be, came back to fill his brain with pain, A pain that was even worse than the pain of alcoholism.
No! No! Go away!
Benton, Missouri, 5 years before. Judge Dempster was studying the transcripts of the third day of a trial that, on the next day, would hear the summations before being remanded to the jury. Dempster paid no attention to the sound of the slamming door, as it was a familiar sound. He should have paid attention to it, because while it was a familiar sound during the day, it was not a normal sound for 10 o'clock at night.
Hello, Judge.
Looking up, Dempster saw three men. All three had been regulars in the courtroom during the trial, but he only knew the name of the one who spoke. That man's name was Carl Mason, and he was the brother of Jed Mason, the defendant in the trial. Jed Mason was being tried for murder in the first degree.
Mason?
Mason didn't wear a beard, but neither was he clean shaven. He had yellow, broken teeth and an unruly mop of brown hair.
Nobody's supposed to be in here at this hour. How'd you get in?
You need to have that lock fixed on the front door. It didn't cause us any trouble at all.
You have no business here.
Oh, well now, Judge, that ain't the way I see it. The way I see it, my brother's gonna get himself hung if this here trial don't come out like it's supposed to. So I figure I got the right of a loving brother to be here.
You're welcome in court tomorrow for closing arguments. I think we will also have a verdict tomorrow.
What'll the verdict be?
Well, Mr. Mason, I have no way of knowing what the verdict will be.
Oh, sure you do. You're the judge, ain't you?
Yes, of course I'm the judge.
Then see to it that my brother gets off.
Mr. Mason, I don't think you understand. I am bound by the decision of the jury. If they find your brother guilty of murder, I will have no choice but to pronounce sentence on him.
Yeah? And what would that sentence be?
That he be hanged by the neck until dead.
That ain't gonna happen.
It very well may. As I told you, it's up to the jury.
Well, you better find some way to make it be up to you. If you don't...
Are you threatening me, Mr. Mason?
You? No, Judge, you ain't the one I'm threatening. I'm threatening them.
Them?
Reaching into his pocket, Mason pulled out something gold and shiny. Then lay it on the desk in front of Dempster.
You recognize this, Judge?
It's Tammy's locket.
Dempster had given his 12-year-old daughter the locket last Christmas, and she was never without it.
And this?
Mason put a wide gold wedding band down. Inside the wedding band were the names Bob and Lil.
Lil's wedding band? What have you done with my family?
You make the right decision tomorrow, and your wife and daughter will be fine.
Please, don't hurt them.
Ah, like I said, Judge, that's all up to you.
Dempster went home to find his wife and daughter missing. There was a note on the receiving table in the foyer.
If you want to see your wife and kid alive again, cut my brother free.
Dempster did not sleep a wink that night. And when he showed up in court the next day, he was exhausted from lack of sleep and sick with worry. As the courtroom filled, he looked out over the gallery and saw Mason and the two men who had come to visit him on the previous night. Mason held up a ribbon that Dempster recognized as having come from his wife's hair. Then smiled at Dempster, a sick, evil smile. Dempster fought back the bile of fear and anger.
Last night, while going over the transcripts, I found clear and compelling evidence of prosecutorial misconduct.
The prosecutor had been examining his notes prior to his summation, but at Dempster's words, he looked up in surprise.
What? Your Honor, what did you say?
Therefore, I am dismissing all charges against the defendant. Mr. Mason, you are free to go.
Prosecutorial misconduct? Judge, have you lost your mind? What are you talking about?
This court is adjourned!
The judge ran back to his home, pushing the door open. Dempster stopped, grabbing at the pain in his heart when he saw them.
Oh, no. No.
His wife and daughter were on the floor of the parlor lying in a pool of dark red blood. They were both dead.
No!
The Missouri Supreme Court offered condolences to Dempster for the loss of his wife and daughter, even as they removed him from the bench and disbarred him. After that, Dempster had no choice but to leave town. He took a train to St. Louis and there boarded a train heading west. He had no particular destination in mind, settling in Purgatory because he felt that the name of the town brought a sense of poetic justice to his own situation. As he explained in a letter he wrote to his brother,
"If I could have found a town named Hell, I would have settled there."
Dempster forced the memories away, returning to the present. A rundown office in a fly-blown town. He looked at the broken bottle and the whiskey stain, which had become symbolic of his life. In the beginning, the drinking seemed to help ease the pain, but as time went by, the whiskey, which had once helped him by temporarily blotting out the memory, took over his soul. The man who had once been the odds-on favorite for appointment to the Supreme Court of Missouri was no more. That man would never be back. Dempster put his head down on his desk.
"Dear God, I cannot get any lower than this. I want to die, but I don't have the courage to kill myself. Take me now, please. Dear God, help me beat this, or take me now."
Incredibly, Dempster's prayer of relinquishment had an almost immediate effect. A sense of calm came over him, a peace that passed all understanding, and he knew what his first step had to be on the long road to recovery. Getting paper and pen from his desk, Dempster wrote a letter to the Honorable John C. Fremont, Governor of Arizona Territory.
"Dear Governor Fremont, my name is Robert Dempster. I am an attorney at law, practicing in Purgatory. I feel it incumbent upon me to call to your attention the condition of affairs here in Purgatory. We are a town that is literally without law, except for the law as administered by Andrew Cummins, who is acting as both marshal and associate judge. I could list a catalog of offenses he has perpetrated and is perpetrating against the citizens of our town, such as draconian taxes and heavy-handed application of the laws he chooses to enforce. To help him, he has a force of no fewer than 8 deputies. All this for a town of less than 300 people. However, it is not to seek relief for our own condition that I write this letter. Rather, it is to point out a specific incident that is so glaring that I believe intervention is in order, either from your own resources or the resources of the federal government. I am talking about the trial, conviction, and sentencing of a man all within 1 hour of the alleged violation. The man in question, Matt Jensen, rode into town innocently enough and was accosted by Mo Gillis, one of Marshal Cummins' deputies. Gillis ordered Jensen to pay a $5 visitor's tax, but Jensen refused, saying he would ride on out of town. In the resultant disagreement, Gillis was killed. Jensen was arrested and brought to trial within minutes of the incident, and I was appointed to defend him. I must, in all candidness, report to you that I am an alcoholic and was debilitated by an excessive use of alcohol. Despite the fact that I was in no condition to mount an adequate defense, I was appointed by Marshal Cummins, who, for purposes of the trial, abandoned his role of marshal and assumed the mantle of associate judge. During the course of the trial, Jensen claimed that Gillis drew first, and my personal knowledge of Mo Gillis is such that I do not find that claim unrealistic. I was given only 15 minutes to prepare for this case, which did not allow me to look for eyewitnesses. Later, an eyewitness came forth to testify that he had seen the incident, and the eyewitness's story confirmed Jensen's claim thus making the killing an act of self-defense. When I took the report to Marshal Cummins, he dismissed it out of hand, and in front of me, ordered one of his deputies to perjure himself by signing a statement that he had also been a witness. I call upon you, Governor, to please intervene in this case to stay the man's execution. He is to be taken to Yuma. And if that is not possible, to please appoint someone to look into the conditions in this town. This town has some decent people, Governor, and could be a vibrant and productive community if only the tyranny of an evil marshal and his minions could be removed. Sincerely, Robert Dempster.
The rider was a big man with brindled gray-black hair, a square chin, and steel-gray eyes that could stare through a man. United States Marshal Ben Kyle's boots were dusty and well-worn. The metal of his spurs had become dull with time. He wore a Colt 44 at his hip and carried a Winchester 44-40 in his saddle sheath. He dismounted, unhooked his canteen, then poured some water into his hat and put it back on his head, enjoying the brief cooling effect. He was running low on water, but figured to reach the monastery before nightfall, and he knew there would be water there. There were no natural sources for water at the monastery, but its water was carried in by barrel from a small, not always dependable, river 12 miles to the east. Kyle was after Emil Taylor and Bart Simmons. 3 days ago, the two men had held up a stage, and because the stage was carrying United States mail, Kyle, a U.S. Marshal, had jurisdiction. The trail had led Kyle here, and he was now convinced that the two were headed for the monastery. That wasn't a hard conclusion to make, because anyone coming this way would have to stop at the monastery, since there was no other source of food or water within several miles in any direction. Stagecoach robbery was not the only crime for which the two men were wanted. Kyle believed they were also involved, along with Cletus Odom, in the attempted robbery of the Bank of Wickenburg a few weeks earlier. No money was taken because of the actions of the bank teller, but those same actions also enraged the robbers so that the teller was killed. Kyle was after Taylor and Simmons, but the one he really wanted was Cletus Odom, the outlaw who had planned and led the robbery attempt. The murder in Wickenburg was not the only thing Odom was wanted for. He was a desperate fugitive whose face was plastered on reward dodgers all across the Southwest. Kyle reached the monastery just before dark. The abbey was surrounded by high stone walls and secured by a heavy oak gate. Kyle pulled on a rope that was attached to a short section of log. The makeshift knocker banged against the large, heavy gates. A moment later, a small window slid open, and a brown hooded face appeared in the opening.
Who are you?
Kyle was a little surprised by the question. The monk on the other side of the gate was Brother James, and because Kyle had been here many times before, he was absolutely certain that James knew who he was. Why was he pretending that he did not know?
My name is Ben Kyle. I'm a United States Marshal.
What do you want?
I'm looking for a couple of men, outlaws, who might have come this way.
Pointedly, the monk cut his eyes to the left. He did that twice.
I'm sorry. This is a holy place. I can't let you in.
The monk cut his eyes to the left again. Kyle nodded once to let the monk know that he understood.
But, brother, I am out of water. You cannot turn me away.
I am truly sorry. God go with you.
The little window slammed shut.
Yeah.
Kyle remounted and rode away from the gate. Taylor and Simmons were standing just inside the gate.
What's he doing now?
He's riding off.
Taylor put his pistol away. He looked at the short, overweight monk.
You done that real good, Padre. I don't think he suspects a thing.
I'm not a priest. Therefore, I am not addressed as father.
Really? Well, hell. Don't matter none to me what you're called. I don't care what I'm called either, as long as I'm called in time for supper. You get it? As long as I'm called in time for supper.
Yes, that's quite amusing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of supper,
What do you say we go see if the cook has our supper finished? I'm starving.
The three men walked back across the little courtyard, which, because of the irrigation system and the loving care bestowed upon it by the brothers of the order, was lush with flowers, fruit trees, and a vegetable garden. There were a dozen or more monks in the yard, each one occupied in some specific task. The building the three men entered was surprisingly cool, kept that way by the hanging gourds of water called olas, which, while sacrificing some of the precious water by evaporation, paid off the investment by lowering the temperature by several degrees.
Brother James, who was at the gate?
A stranger, Father Gaston. I do not know who he was.
And you denied him sanctuary?
I had no choice, Father.
Brother James rolled his eyes toward Taylor and Simmons.
You sent him away?
Taylor was a small man with a ferret-like face and skin that was heavily pocked from the scars of some childhood disease.
He was a United States Marshal. United States Marshal ain't exactly someone we want around now.
I see. Still, to turn someone away is unthinkable. It is a show of Christian kindness to offer water, food, and shelter to those who ask it of us.
Yeah, well, there's enough of that Christian kindness going on now, what with you taking care of us and all. Now, what about the food? How long does it take your cook to fix a little supper?
Forgive me for not mentioning it the moment you came in. The cook has informed me that your supper is ready.
Well, now that's more like it. Why didn't you say something? Come on, Simmons. Let's me and you get something to eat.
Brother James led the two outlaws into the dining room. The room was bare, except for one long wooden table, flanked on either side by an attached wooden bench. On the mud-plaster-covered walls, there hung a large crucifix with the body of Jesus, clearly depicting the agony of the Passion. Simmons stood there looking at it for a moment.
I tell you the truth, that would be one hell of a way to die.
What would be?
That.
Taylor looked around, then shrugged.
Yeah? Well, I doubt that hanging is any better. More than likely, me and you both are gonna wind up getting ourselves hung.
Don't talk like that.
I'm just telling the facts of life is all.
Taylor looked at Brother James.
What about the supper that was supposed to be ready?
Here it comes now.
Another monk, who, like Brother James, was wearing a simple brown homespun cassock held together with a rope around his waist, came into the dining room then, carrying a tray. Their dinner consisted of a bowl of beans and a crust of bread.
What the hell is this?
This is your supper.
Is this it? What about that Christian kindness you were talking about? You didn't offer us no meat.
I'm sorry, in this order we do not eat meat. We cannot offer you what we do not have.
Yeah? Are you telling me this is what you people eat?
Only one day in three do we get beans. The other 2 days we get bread only.
Hell, it ain't that bad, Taylor. It ain't bad at all. In fact, it's kind of tasty. And it sure as hell beats jerky.
Kyle waited until after dark before he returned to the monastery. Leaving his horse hobbled, he slipped up to one of the side walls. Then, using chinks and holes in the stone facade to provide footholds and handholds, he climbed up, slipped over the top, and dropped to the ground inside the abbey walls. Most of the buildings inside the monastery grounds were dark, for candles and oil lamps were precious commodities to be used sparingly. Here and there, Kyle saw that some light did manage to escape through the windows of those buildings where there was light. The grounds themselves were not totally dark, though, because the moon was full and bright, and the chapel, dormitory, stable, and grain storage buildings all gleamed in a soft silver light like white blossoms sprouting from desert cactus. With his gun in hand and staying in the shadows alongside the wall, Kyle moved toward the building that he knew to be the dining hall. He was sure they would be inside there, because it was one of the few buildings that had a light. Finding a window, he looked inside. There he saw Taylor, Simmons, and Brother James. Though he had been certain that Taylor and Simmons were here, this was his first actual confirmation of the fact. Taylor and Simmons were eating, and Kyle thought that might give him the opportunity he needed to sneak up on them. Moving toward the front door, He opened it. Except for a single candle on the table, the room was dark, and that enabled Kyle to step inside, then slip quickly into the shadows.
Bring me some more beans and bread.
Yeah, and some bacon.
I told you we do not eat meat in this order.
What the hell?
Taylor stood up and spun around toward Kyle.
Hold it right there. Drop your gun belts.
Glaring at him, their features contorted by the candlelight, the two outlaws unbuckled their gun belts and dropped them.
What are you planning on doing with us?
I'm taking you back to jail.
There's two of us and only one of you. Plus, it's a long way back. How do you plan to do that?
That's not your problem.
You'll never get us back.
Oh, I'll get you back, all right. Either sitting in your saddle or draped over it.
When Kyle and his two prisoners rode into Sentinel 2 days later, the two riders were handcuffed and connected to each other by a rope. They stopped in front of the marshal's office.
Yeah, get down.
It ain't going to be all that easy, what with us being handcuffed and tied together with a rope.
Oh, I'll help.
Kyle gave Simmons a shove.
You need help too?
No, I can get down on my own.
Kyle herded them into the office.
Back there.
Say, Marshal, I'm getting a little hungry here. What time you serve supper?
I'll bring you a biscuit and bacon.
Kyle put them into the cell, then closed the door and locked it.
Stick your hands through the bars.
Can't get through. What with these handcuffs?
Hold one hand on top of the other. You can do it.
The prisoners complied, and Kyle removed their handcuffs, then hung them on a hook.
Now, you boys behave yourselves. I'm going to get a beer.
Hey, Marshal, will you bring back them biscuits? You reckon you could bring us a beer?
Oh, that's real funny, Simmons.
When Kyle opened the door to the Oxbow Saloon a couple of minutes later, he saw his deputy, Boomer Foley, sitting at a table with Sally Fontaine, the saloon owner. Boomer was a slender man, almost skinny, but appearances were deceiving. Kyle had seen Boomer in action, and he was more than able to handle himself. Sally was a very attractive, auburn-haired woman in her late 30s. She was a widow who had inherited the saloon when her husband was shot and killed by a drunken patron. Most expected Sally to sell the saloon and go back to Virginia, where her father had once been a United States congressman. They were surprised when she announced her intention of remaining in Sentinel to run the Oxbow. Few thought she would succeed, but it was now 3 years since Marty Fontaine was killed, and the Oxbow had not only survived, it did a thriving business.
Marshal, welcome back. Come over here and join us. We just talking about Doc Presnell, wondering what kind of trip he had.
Is Doc back?
Not yet. He's coming in on the 7:30 train tonight.
Where'd he go again?
Don't you remember? He was in St. Louis attending some medical conference.
Doc's not the only one on the train tonight.
What do you mean?
Boomer pulled a telegram from his pocket.
We got this from the marshal back in Purgatory. I reckon he sent it over to every lawman between Purgatory and Yuma.
Boomer handed the page to Kyle.
Attention all law officers. Stop. Please be advised that prisoner Matt Jensen will be in custody on tonight's train to Yuma. Stop. Jensen has been tried for murder, convicted and sentenced to be hanged. Stop. Marshal Andrew Cummins. Are you sure that's tonight's train?
Yeah, I'm sure. We got the telegram this afternoon.
That's funny. I haven't heard of any murder trial being conducted back in Purgatory.
Could be that it happened while you was gone. But don't forget, you've been gone for a few days now.
Still, that seems awfully fast to have a murder, hold a trial, then sentence a man.
Do you know this here Marshal Cummins?
Only by reputation. I've heard that he's pretty a domineering sort. But if he's the man the people of Purgatory want, who am I to question him?
Kyle turned to Sally and smiled.
I heard a rumor that a man could get a beer in this place if he knew the right people.
Fred, bring Marshal Kyle a beer.
The man nodded and began to pour the Marshal a beer.
I take it that was Taylor and Simmons I see you riding with a few minutes ago?
Yeah.
Did you have a hard time tracking them?
Wasn't hard at all. Once I saw that they were going southwest from Sentinel, I knew there was only one place they could go.
The monastery?
The monastery.
If any of them outlaws ever get a lick of sense about them, this law business will be a lot harder. You think they didn't have any idea you'd know exactly where they would be, where they would have to be?
I'm not sure they even thought about it.
Yeah, you'll be charging them with robbing that stagecoach, right?
Yeah, but I'm also sure they took part in that bank robbery up in Wickenburg. So I'm hoping they'll shed some light on where to find Cletus Odom.
Ben, do you actually think those two men will tell you anything about Odom?
Oh, I think so. As far as I know, neither Taylor nor Simmons have ever done murder. That is, until the attempted bank robbery in Wickenburg.
I thought all the witnesses said it was Odom who shot him.
Well, that's right. But just by being there, that makes Taylor and Simmons every bit as guilty as Odom. I want them to know that, because then I'll offer them a deal. It could be that if they think they are facing a hanging, they might turn on Odom to save their hides.
I sure'd love to get Odom. He's one evil son of a bitch. Yo, I beg your pardon, Miss Sally. I'm sorry about that.
No need to apologize for telling the truth.
Yes, ma'am. But I hadn't ought to have used language like that in front of a lady.
Boomer, I run a saloon. Believe me, there's very little I haven't heard. Have you had your supper, Ben?
Well, no, I haven't.
Would you like to join me for supper down at Del Monte's, my treat?
Well, now, how could I pass up an offer like that? Boomer, how about getting a couple of bacon and biscuit sandwiches to take to our prisoners?
All right, then I'll make the rounds. But I plan to be down to the depot to meet that train when it gets in. Are you two going to be there?
Sally and Kyle exchanged a smiling glance.
We may, and we may not.
Well, you want to greet Doc, won't you? I mean, he's been gone for the better part of a month. Of course, if you're not there to meet him, it won't really matter none. I'll bring Doc down a drink if he wants one.
You do that, Boomer. And tell Fred that anything you and Doc drink tonight will be on me.
Well, Miss Sally, that's just real nice of you now.
As the train to Yuma hurtled across the desert, Deputy Hayes walked over to the door of the express car and slid it open. The wind caused several papers to fly around inside the car.
Here, what are you doing?
I'm taking a piss out the door.
I have to have this mail sorted by the time we reach Sentinel. I can't do it with all this wind coming through the door. Close the door.
All right, hold your horses. As soon as I shake the lily a bit, I'll close the door.
Matt watched and listened to the exchange between the two men. Matt could smell the smoke that drifted in from the engine, and one gleaming ember even landed on the table of the mail cabinet that was in front of Kingsley. Agitatedly, Kingsley stamped out the glowing ember.
Oh, you're gonna set us on fire!
Hayes slid the door shut.
Oh, damn! Kingsley, if you ain't like some old woman, you ain't done nothing but bitch since we left Purgatory.
I'm not just a passenger on the train, you know. I have work to do.
Well, go on. I ain't stopping you.
Hayes moved back up to the front of the car where Matt was sitting on the floor with his back against the wall.
Hey, Jensen, you ever see a man get hung?
Yes.
Yeah, I have too. It sure is fun to watch. It ain't pretty. What with the man getting himself hung, having his face go all purple, and his eyes bugging out like they do. Yeah, no, no, it ain't pretty. But damn, it's fun to watch.
I don't enjoy them as much as you do.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll enjoy this one more, seeing as you're going to be the star. Just think, you'll be standing up there on the gallows with everyone looking right at you while the hangman puts his noose around your neck.
He's made a motion with his hand as if putting on a noose.
Then, next thing you know, well, they'll open that trap door under you and you'll fall through. Hey, what do you think? Yeah, pretty good, wasn't it?
The sun was a bright red disc just resting on the western horizon. Bands of red and purple laced across the sky as Cletus Odom stood in the middle of the tracks, looking back toward the east. The twin ribbons of steel glinted in the setting sun, shining red until they disappeared into the gathering dusk to the east.
See anything yet?
Not yet, Bates.
Maybe we already missed it.
We haven't missed it.
Odom turned back toward the three men who were bending over the tracks.
How's it coming?
We pulled out a couple of the spikes, but they're damn hard to remove.
They're supposed to be hard to get out. All you have to do is pull up enough of them to be able to push the rail out a few inches.
You sure that'll stop the train?
You ever seen a train run on dirt?
No.
Well, if you push that rail out, the only place the train can go is dirt. Yeah, I'm sure this'll stop it.
Senor, how much money is on the train?
How much you got now?
Maybe I have $1.
Then it doesn't really matter how much money the train is carrying, does it? Whatever it is, it'll be more than you got. Schuler?
Yeah?
You have to blow the safe. You gonna be able to handle it? Or are you drunk?
I can do the job.
You damn well better be able to do the job. Hurry it up!
Odom came over to join them. As working quickly, they pulled up two more spikes.
Bates, you're the biggest one here. Pick up the sledgehammer and hit the rail here a couple of times, just enough to push it out.
Bates grabbed the hammer and hit it. The rail popped out. He was about to hit it a second time when Odom stopped him. It was less than 2 minutes after the men put the tools away when they first saw the train. As the engine approached, it gave some perspective as to how large the desert really was. For the train that had appeared so tiny before was now a behemoth, blocking out the sky.
Get ready, boys. It's nearly here.
Say, how long before we reach the next town anyways? What I need to do is... I need to get off this train and get me a beer. Maybe a bottle of whiskey, too.
No alcoholic spirits are allowed in the express car.
Yeah, so what are you gonna do about it? Go to the law? I'm the law.
No, I'm not going to the law. If you want a drink, I can't stop you. But I can report you to the railroad.
Yeah, and what'll the railroad do? Tell me I'm a bad boy.
Well, for one thing, they will see to it that you can't ride a train anymore.
Yeah, and that's supposed to mean something to me.
It means you better not consider going anywhere you can't walk or ride a horse.
What are you laughing at?
Seems to me like Mr. Kingsley has the upper hand.
Yeah?
Stepping over to Matt, Hayes suddenly slapped Matt in the face.
There ain't nothing you can do about that, seeing as you're all chained up like you are. Tell me, Mr. Killer, who has the upper hand now?
Hayes was standing over Matt with his legs spread, looking down at Matt, who was still on the floor. Matt smiled up at him.
What are you smiling at, you son of a bitch?
I'm about to show you who has the upper hand.
It was at that exact point in time that the engine ran across the place where the rail had been compromised. For a moment, the train continued on as if nothing had happened.
What the hell? Nothing happened! The train didn't stop!
Just wait!
Less than a second later, they saw the engine quiver, then drop down on one side. The engine continued forward, but now one side was producing thrust while the other had lost its purchase. The driver wheels in the dirt now continued to churn full speed, and they began throwing up a huge rooster tail of sand. First the engine, then the tender, then the express car tumbled over on their sides. The following cars began breaking apart and falling in upon themselves. The boiler of the engine suddenly exploded. The explosion of the boiler had sent hundreds of burning embers of coal from the engine's firebox. Those coals had landed on the wooden passenger cars, most nearly reduced to kindling wood by the wreck, so that within seconds, the cars, many of which still had people trapped in the wreckage, caught on fire.
Son of a bitch, that wasn't supposed to happen. I thought all would happen was the train would stop. I didn't know it was going to wreck.
Yeah, well, the train did stop, though, didn't it, Schuler? Oh, Jesus. Most of the passenger cars are on fire. Yo, come on. Let's get an express car, get the money, and get out before it catches fire, too.
Well, this ain't right. You never said anything about killing all these people. All you said was that we was gonna rob a train.
Yeah, well, how the hell was I supposed to get it to stop? Stand in front of it and hold out my hand?
Mr. Kingsley! Mr. Kingsley! Hayes! Hayes, you all right?
Matt had no idea as to the seriousness of Hayes' condition. Matt pulled himself through the strewn wreckage of the car until he reached Hayes.
Hayes?
Hayes was out cold, but his steady breathing told Matt that he wasn't dead. Matt searched through Hayes' pockets until he found the key to his shackles. He was just about to unlock them when he heard someone jerking open the door. He wasn't sure who was trying to get into the car, but because he was in shackles, he thought it might not be a good idea to be seen. Holding onto the key, he moved quickly away, then hid behind an overturned cabinet. Matt saw four men with guns drawn climbing into the car. The fact that they were holding guns told him that they weren't here as rescuers. A closer look at one of the men confirmed that it was the same man he had encountered in the alley back in Wickenburg. This was Cletus Odom.
Señor, hemos hecho en desorden grande.
What's that, Paco? I don't speak mix.
I said, we have made a big mess.
What did you expect? When you wreck a train, you make a mess. Now let's find a safe. Schuler, get ready to blow it.
Well, there are women and children on this train. You didn't tell me that we might be killing women and children on this thing, right? I wouldn't have come along if I'd have known this was gonna happen. Now, we ought to do something to help these people.
Are you crazy? You want to get hung? That's what's gonna happen if you start trying to help anyone now. All you gotta do is blow the safe so we can get the money and get out of here.
There ain't no need to blow the safe.
Why not? What are you talking about, Bates?
The money's all in the canvas pouch. I found it.
Is the pouch locked?
Nope.
Bates stuck his hand down inside and pulled out a couple of bound stacks of currency notes.
It's full of money.
Damn, I wonder how much.
$20,000.
What? How do you know that?
Bates pulled out a piece of paper and smiled at the others.
Because it's all being counted out for us.
$20,000? Ah, caramba. That is a lot of money, I think.
We're rich, boys. We're rich.
This ain't right. There ain't none of this right.
Well, if you don't like it, you don't have to take your cut. Come on, boys. Let's go.
What happened?
He's alive.
Drawing his gun, Odom aimed it at Hayes.
Not no more, he ain't. Dumb son of a bitch. All he had to do was be quiet for one more minute and he wouldn't have got himself killed. Now come on, let's get out of here before somebody looks in here.
Matt waited until all four men had left the car before he moved from his hiding place. Using the key he had taken from Hayes, he unlocked his shackles. After that, he strapped on Hayes' pistol, then looked down at him.
Like the fella said, Hayes, if you'd been quiet for one more minute, you'd still be alive.
Armed and free, Matt climbed out of the car. When Matt jumped down from the express car, he was totally unprepared for the carnage he saw. The next car after the express car was the baggage car, and the passenger car following it was telescoped into it. The next three passenger cars, while not overturned, were jackknifed, piled up onto each other, and burning. Scattered luggage and clothing created a patchwork quilt of bright colors alongside the track. Outside, a few of the people had begun to function again, and they started back into the cars to pull out more of the injured.
Get the ones out of the cars that are already burning first.
Leading by example, Matt moved up to the first car. At the front of the car, he saw the woman and the little boy, Jerry, who he had seen in the train depot. Jerry was unhurt and free to move around, but he was sitting on the floor by his mother. Matt saw then why Jerry hadn't left the train. The boy's mother was trapped under the seat. Matt crawled in through the window and worked his way through the smoke and bloody carnage until he reached the front of the car.
Hello, Jerry. How are you?
Matt had overheard the woman talking to the child in the depot.
I'm all right, but Mama can't get up.
Ma'am, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Are you hurt?
Oh, I think I may have broken my arm.
What about Susie?
Oh, she's here with me. We're both jammed in here and can't move. I'm worried about Susie. She hasn't made a sound.
Let me see what I can do.
The woman and her young daughter were wedged in between the front seat and the collapsed front wall of the car. In addition, the side wall was crushed in as well and pressing down on the seat. Matt grabbed the seat in his bear-like grip. The seat broke loose from its mount, and Matt pulled it completely free. He tossed the seat aside, then reached down for the woman.
Can you walk?
Yes.
The woman stood there with her arm held against her stomach.
There's nothing wrong with my legs. I can walk. Please, get Susie.
Matt got down on his hands and knees and looked up under the collapsed wall. Susie was dead. Impaled by a piece of wood that had torn from the side of the car. It looked away quickly, and the woman saw his reaction.
No. Oh, God, no. Is she dead?
Yes. I'm sorry, ma'am.
Please, get her out for me.
I should get you and Jerry off the train first and see if there's someone who can take care of your arm.
No, please, get my baby for me. Get her out of there.
All right, I'll get her for you.
Reaching back under the collapsed wall, Matt pulled out the piece of wood that had speared through her little body. Then, gently, he pulled her out.
My baby!
She reached for the little girl with her good arm. Matt handed the girl to her mother, then led the mother and Jerry out of the car. One of the passengers was a doctor, and though he was bloodied and bruised, he was not seriously injured. Putting aside his own injuries, he had the impromptu rescuers bring all those who were hurt to one place so he could look after them as best he could under the circumstances. Matt took the woman to him.
Mrs. Dobbs, I didn't know you were on the train.
Doctor, it's Susie.
Let me look at her.
Dr. Presnell reached out to take the child from Mrs. Dobbs' arms.
No!
Mrs. Dobbs twisted away from the doctor's reach.
Susie?
Dr. Presnell looked at Matt, and Matt shook his head sadly.
All right, Louise. You can hold on to your little girl, but let me look at your arm.
Mrs. Dobbs, won't you let me hold Susie for you until Dr. Presnell has examined your arm?
Mrs. Dobbs hesitated for a moment, then nodded and gave the little girl to him. Dr. Presnell looked at her arm.
Oh!
Hey, Jerry, I want you to look around and find me two pieces of wood about 8 inches long.
All right.
I'm going to make a splint. If I can find some way to hold it in place.
There's some items of clothing strewn about. I'll collect some of it. Maybe we can tear some of that into strips.
Good idea.
Matt started to walk away, still carrying the dead body.
No! Don't take her away from me!
I'll bring her right back, Mrs. Dobbs, I promise.
Louise, I need his help if I'm going to fix your arm.
All right.
Mrs. Dobbs did not take her eyes off Matt as he wandered around through the strewn items of clothing, all the while carrying the dead child. Finally, he found a shirt, which he ripped into strips. Then he took the strips of cloth back to the doctor. By now, Jerry had returned with several pieces of wood gathered from the wreckage of the train.
Good work, Jerry.
Selecting two pieces that most suited his purpose, and using the strips of cloth Matt gave him, he made a splint. As soon as he was finished, Mrs. Dobbs reached for Susie, and gently, Matt returned the child to her. Farther up the track in Sentinel, the people who were waiting to meet the train were beginning to grow nervous. The train was already 45 minutes late. Boomer, who was waiting to meet Doc Presnell, was listening in to the various conversations of those who were expecting people on the train. They were growing increasingly more concerned.
Hey, Deputy Foley, have you heard anything? My daughter is supposed to be coming in on the train, and I'm growing very worried.
Oh, I wouldn't worry much about that, Mrs. Anderson. The train's been late before.
Oh, yes, sir, I know it has. But if you go over there and look at the blackboard that has the schedule on it, you'll see that the train left Purgatory on time. It should have been here a long time ago now.
Well, it does seem a little odd, doesn't it? Yeah, all right. I'll go talk to the station agent and see what I can find out.
Oh, would you? Oh, good, I appreciate that. And I'm sure a lot of other folks will appreciate it just as much.
Boomer went inside the depot, then walked back to the ticket cage. There, he saw the station agent standing over the telegrapher. The telegraph instrument was clacking away madly.
Mr. Cooley?
The station agent held up his hand as a signal for Boomer to be quiet for a moment, so Boomer complied. The telegraph key stopped clacking. Then the telegrapher put his own hand on the key and sent a short message back.
Now, deputy, what can I do for you?
Mr. Cooley, all the folks here that are waiting on the train, well, they're beginning to get a little worried.
Who are they now?
Yes, sir, they are, and I don't mind telling you, yet I'm somewhat worried myself.
Well, why are you worried, deputy? You don't have any people on the train, do you?
No, sir, but there's lots of folks out there who do have people, even family, and they got a right to know what's happening. And it just so happens that Doc is on the train, and Doc, being a friend of mine, well, that gives me cause to worry as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, Boomer. I had no right to act like that. The truth is, I'm worried as well.
Has something happened? I mean, that you know?
Oh, well, what I know is that we got a telegram that the train left Purgatory Station 1 hour and 47 minutes ago. The normal time it takes the train to get here is just over an hour.
You think something has happened? Or Could they have just stopped somewhere?
Well, there is no place to stop between here and Purgatory. No, sir, Deputy, I'm sure something's happened.
A wreck?
I think so.
Oh, then you're gonna have to tell these folks.
I'm afraid to.
Afraid to? Why on earth would you be afraid to?
If there has been a train wreck, and I suspect there has been, I don't know how they're going to take it.
Mr. Cooley, it'd be my notion that they'd rather hear the truth than stand around worrying about it, not knowing one way or the other.
Would you tell them?
Well, yes, sir, I could, I suppose. But that's more than likely something the marshal should tell them.
Where's the marshal?
But he's a... Oh.
Boomer was sure Marshal Kyle was with Sally Fontaine, and he didn't figure that was anybody's business.
Never mind. I'll tell him.
Boomer walked out of the depot, then held up his hands and started calling for everyone's attention.
People! 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 Can I have your attention, please? People! The train left Purgatory on time, but as you can plainly see, it hasn't made it here yet. That leads us to believe that there has been a train wreck somewhere between here and Purgatory.
Oh, my God, no! Oh, how bad is it? Are many hurt? Was anyone killed?
Now, hold on here. The truth is, we don't even know for sure that there was one.
But you just said there was.
No, I said we believe there has been one. Given that the train ain't here yet and it should ought to be, well, it just seems most likely that a wreck was what happened. And, of course, the next thing is, if there has been a wreck, well, we don't know how bad it might be.
Oh, boy. Well, is it possible that there wasn't any wreck at all? That the train may have just broken down out on the road?
Boomer turned to look at Cooley, who was standing beside him.
What about that, Mr. Cooley? Is it maybe possible that the train had just broke down on the track somewhere?
Yes, of course that is possible.
Well then, maybe we don't have anything to be worried about at all.
It's possible, but it's not very likely.
What do you mean, it's not very likely? Why not?
The reason I say that a simple breakdown is unlikely is because it... If that is what has happened, why, they have a little gadget on board that will allow them to clamp onto the telegraph wire so as to be able to send a message. Or most of the time, when it's no more than a breakdown, they'll be able to get in contact with us to let us know. But there hasn't been any such message. So, I hate to say this, but I'm afraid we have to assume the worst.
If there has been a wreck, we'll need to organize a rescue party, so I hope several of us will be going out there. So if you'll wait a bit, I'll go get the marshal. I expect he'll be putting together a rescue party, and I'm sure you'll want to be part of it.
Marshal Kyle was lying in bed with his hands laced behind his head. Sally was lying on her side, with her head elevated and supported by her left hand. The way she was lying, with her arm crooked at the elbow, caused the bedsheet to slide down and expose both her breasts.
What? What are you laughing at?
Oh, nothing.
You're laughing at something. I can see it in your face.
Well, I was just thinking of what a difference one day can make. Last night, I had to be satisfied with some Indian girl I saw on the trail. Now, here I am with a beautiful white woman in her own bed.
What? What Indian girl?
Oh, Nick, I'm just joking.
That's nothing to joke about.
Sally got up and jerked the cover off the bed so that both were exposed. They looked at each other for a moment, then Kyle reached for her.
On the other hand, this is no joke.
Indian girl, my foot.
Marshall? Marshal Kyle, you in there?
Just a minute, Boomer. Just a minute. Give me a minute now.
Yes, sir. I don't mean to disturb you and Miss Sally none, but, well, this is important.
Well, it damn well better be.
A few moments later, when both were fully dressed, Kyle walked over to sit on a settee. He nodded toward Sally as a signal that she could open the door now.
Good evening, Boomer.
Evening, ma'am. Is Marshal here?
I'm here in the parlor, Boomer. What is it? What is so all fired up important?
It's about the train, Marshal. Doc's train.
What about Doc's train? Did he miss it?
No, sir. Well, that is... Well, I don't know.
No, he didn't miss it, or you don't know? Which is it?
I mean, the train ain't got in yet.
The train hasn't arrived?
Kyle glanced at the wall clock. The clock read 5 minutes until 9.
Huh. It was supposed to arrive at 7:30, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. Yeah, Mr. Cooley, he got a telegram that said the train left Purgatory Station on time. The thing is, Marshal, it don't take but little over an hour to get here. But the train's already an hour and a half late.
Does Cooley know where it is? What happened to it?
No, sir, I don't reckon he does know. There don't nobody know.
Saddle our horses. We'll ride down the track toward Purgatory and see what we can find.
We could do that, or we could...
We could do what?
Well, we could take a train. Cooley's putting on the switch engine, and he plans to run it back down the track toward Purgatory. If the train left Purgatory when it was supposed to, and when the folks back in Purgatory said it did, then we'll find it quicker by going on a train than if we was going back riding horses.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Also, if there was a wreck, we'd need the train to bring the people back to Sentinel.
Yes, sir.
Well, come along then. No sense in wasting time here.
No, sir. I figured you'd be wanting to get on this right away. Miss Sally, I'm sorry to be busting in like this. Breaking up your welcome home to Marshal Kyle and all.
Don't you worry about it, Boomer. You did the right thing. If there was a train wreck, Ben needs to get out there as fast as he can.
Yes, ma'am. That's sort of what I was thinking, too.